you know, I've been looking forward to talking to you for a long time for a few reasons. One, you're a fantastic player, and I think you're one of the people out there really pushing the boundaries of the instrument, especially as a solo voice. And that's something we talked about a lot in the course is tapping. Mm. But also, I think you represent, I think, a new direction for people looking to make a career out of music, and that is as a content creator on YouTube. You know, people perhaps of my generation and older are not as naturally familiar with that. So I'm excited to talk with you about that. But before we do that, let's get a little bit of your background. So you're originally from the UK, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, so I grew up in England and I lived there until I was 19. You know, just went to school. And then I actually did a year of a physics degree.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because, you know, in school, I was pretty good with maths and stuff and science type subjects. And I was really into music in school, and I was playing in bands, and I was playing piano and also bass. But, you know, no one in my family is a professional musician or anything like that. I grew up in quite a small town, so, you know, there wasn't really any like music scene or anything like that. And doing music professionally didn't really seem like a realistic option at first. So, you know, I was kind of like, okay, let's do something that I'm good at initially. And that's why I did my year of physics. Mm-hmm. but right before I did that, I did a Berkeley 5-week course.
Ah.
Yeah, that's like, you know, the summer program they have at Berkeley. And
so how old were you roughly when that happened?
I was 18 at that point.
And you've been playing bass since you were 11 or 12?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, I've been playing bass for like 7 years at that point. And that was the first time I'd ever had kind of contemporary music education. Like, everything up until that point had been classical music education. And it was just like this, you know, mind-blowing experience. It was just like, at Berkeley, there's all these classes, like funk and fusion bass lines and stuff like that. I was like, I had no idea you can actually learn this at a school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just absolutely loved it. You know, it was a 5-week thing. I was in America by myself, and it was just a really cool experience. And throughout my year of physics, I was kind of like thinking back to that, like,
yeah,
wow, that was really fun.
That was more fun.
And that was kind of
differential equations.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Physics is hard.
It's literally physics. Yeah.
Yeah.
Challenging.
And you know, while I was doing the physics, I was like practicing bass so much anyway. I was like, I think music is actually my passion. I think that's what I would be happy spending all of my time doing, whereas I couldn't say the same thing about physics. You know, I like some of the concepts in physics, but it's not something that I would do in my free time. It's not something I would do for fun.
I wonder even how you do physics for fun. I don't know what that looks like, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there are some cool videos you can watch online.
Watch YouTube.
Stuff, yeah. But yeah. So, you know, that's the kind of the point where I was like, okay, I think I actually want to do music. I enrolled in Berkeley full time. Initially, you know, I told myself like, we'll see how it goes. Like, but I think deep down I knew that that's what I wanted to do full time.
Yeah, that's kind of similar to my story. I know what you mean. Were your parents supportive, or were they skeptical but cautiously supportive, or how'd that go?
They were pretty supportive.
Oh, good.
I think they knew that it was going to be a really risky option. But they never kind of really tried to push me away from it. You know, it was, I think they could really tell they enjoyed it. And they actually came out at the end of the 5-week Berkeley program. There was like a concert and they actually came out to that, and they like watched me perform. Cool. And I think they kind of got the whole vibe, and they were like, all right, it seems like he's really passionate about it. So yeah, they were pretty supportive.
That's great. That helps.
Yeah, definitely.
So you said that your earliest training was all in the classical realm. So did that include on bass? I understand that on piano, but were you playing classical bass somehow? Were you playing acoustic or playing upright?
No, I've never really played much upright bass. I guess I started piano when I was 7, so I actually started that before bass. And I was playing a lot of classical on piano. And then I had bass lessons in school, and that was more kind of like rock and stuff like that. It was a lot more laid back. It was a lot more like I would bring in a song that I really liked, my teacher would tab it out for me, and then I would learn it. So I did get some exposure, you know, some education in more like contemporary stuff there. But all of the other music classes at school, besides just those bass lessons, everything else was pretty classical focused. I never really got that much into. I didn't know anything about jazz harmony, for example. Like,
yeah.
First time I got to Berkeley, 2/5 and stuff. I was like, I don't know what this is.
Right.
I remember at the 5-week program, they put like a jazz chart in front of me, and
you're just like,
yeah, the
physics was harder.
Yeah, exactly. They just like counted off the tune, and then I was like, well, there's no notes. There's no right. notes. Like, what do you want me to play? Like,
right. Yeah. That's intimidating.
Yeah.
Did you So, I mean, coming up on piano, my story is similar. I started as very young on piano, and that made me a good reader. Did you have the same experience? Were you able to read pretty well?
Yeah, definitely. Like, that was actually one thing at Berkeley, which I was kind of better at than some of the other bass players. Like, they were way better than me at, like, you know, improvising walking bass lines, but a lot of them couldn't read at all. Like, whereas it was the opposite way around for me. Like, I could read bass music, like, pretty well, pretty quickly.
Yeah. Did you find the other cool thing I think about starting on piano is, you know, when you're learning harmony and you're starting to learn, you know, the theory, particularly as it's applied in jazz, you're learning about the way chords are constructed.
Mm.
For me, I know I envisioned the keyboard in my mind when I was thinking about intervals and thinking about voicings of chords. Is that the same for you? Because I think that's a big advantage to have that in your mind's eye.
Definitely.
To picture things, yeah.
Yeah, there's something about the piano where it's, you know, it's like all laid out in kind of the most logical way of any instrument from my experience.
Yeah.
So when I'm thinking of chords, I do often think of like the keyboard rather than the bass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus you can go and, you know, hear it, you know, you make them happen on your own too.
Exactly.
Right. So play piano, Kev.
Yeah, definitely.
It's good for you. So I'm curious, like, what were you into musically? You know, what were you listening to when, and you know, as you were, let's say, getting to Berkeley exposed you to a whole bunch of new music you never encountered. But
definitely.
Up until that point, what were you listening to?
I was really into like rock, and a little bit of like metal. Mm-hmm. I was really into I was obsessed with Metallica for a while. I really loved bands like Foo Fighters, Muse, they're like a UK rock band, older stuff like Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, Guns N' Roses and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's like all I listened to when I was in high school, basically. I didn't have much exposure to jazz and funk and stuff like that.
Mm.
But yeah, then when I went to, actually right before I went to Berkeley is kind of when I discovered people like Victor Wooten. He was the guy who kind of really got me into like solo style of playing bass. Mm.
Do you remember that first experience hearing him? Like I do, for me, is like, I didn't know you could do all that. Like,
definitely.
What?
Yeah, there are like, there are moments in kind of like my musical journey that I can really remember clearly. Like one of the first moments that I kind of fell in love with the idea of playing like rock and stuff was when I saw One by Metallica, the crazy tapping mm-hmm. guitar solo. I was like, that's amazing. And that's what really made me fall in love with rock and metal.
Mm.
And then, it was the same thing with Victor Wooten when I saw him playing Amazing Grace. There's like a live version of him playing Amazing Grace.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I've never heard a bass sound this beautiful and melodic and funky all at the same time.
Yeah.
He was playing, because I was like, how is he playing melody, rhythm, harmony all at the same time?
Yeah.
And I remember just being blown away by that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is incredible. Still incredible, you know.
Yeah.
So you ended up at Berkeley as a undergraduate student there. Talk to me a bit about that experience. You know, I've known a lot of people that went there, and you know, the consensus is mixed on what it offers. But I think it at least exposes you to all kinds of things that you wouldn't have checked out, and you get to meet people and form a network. So, what was your experience of Berkeley?
Yeah, it was. It definitely opened my eyes to a lot of other music that I would never have experienced before, like especially jazz. You know, jazz is kind of the focus of Berkeley still, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was really cool actually, because also I'd never been in an environment like that where there's just so many really great musicians all in the same place. You know, at my high school, I was like, you know, definitely one of like the top musicians. Whereas at Berkeley, you know, I was kind of, like, everyone's good at different things, obviously, but, like, there were people who were, like, light years ahead of me in jazz and stuff like that.
True.
So it was, like, definitely pretty humbling from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was great. You know, what I found was most beneficial about Berkeley was actually my private teacher. I had lessons with Jim Stinnett, and it was great because he wasn't trying to put me in a box of being, you know, like the classic bass player. He saw that I was interested in soloistic stuff. And I think a lot of other teachers might have said, okay, that's cool, but like, let's focus on, you know, learning the stuff that's going to get you the gigs.
Right.
I think he kind of foresaw the fact that it would be really beneficial to have the ability to play solo and stuff like that. And, you know, he definitely didn't disregard playing actually just normal
bass,
conventional
doing the
bass.
Job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think he kind of saw the way things are now and that might not necessarily be enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might not put you in the most stable position if you can only do that, if you can only play regular bass.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a good idea to be able to do something that can really, you know, change the way people think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he kind of just, like, let me dive in, like, all in with the solo stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that points to, like, how critical... in a formative moment, a great teacher can be, right?
Definitely.
To setting you on the path.
Yeah.
Did you find, I mean, you know, it's hard enough being 18 or whatever and going to college, being alone, being in a new country even, in your case. Did you find that, because it sounds to me like you were maybe a little iconoclastic, right? You were sort of going against the grain in a sense. Is that how it felt at the time, that you were more interested in solo bass than the, maybe the more traditional things? How did that fit as you were also kind of developing your own voice and just maturing as a person? Like, do you remember that process at all? Was it rocky or was it smooth for you?
It definitely felt to some extent like I was going against the grain.
Mm.
The cool thing, though, was that my teacher kind of had like almost his own little community. It was pretty interesting. He almost had like a little sub community within Berkeley because he had a lot of students and he had events outside of Berkeley. He had these like workshops outside of Berkeley.
Oh, cool.
And like a lot of his students would come to those as well.
Mm.
And a lot of them were doing, you know, pretty crazy stuff. Like, I had one friend who was really, really focused on slap, and he was playing, like, all this crazy, like, Marcus Miller-style slap stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, because of that, I never felt too much like I was, you know, some really weird guy just, like, doing some weird solo bass thing that no one else is interested in. Like, there were other people around me who were also pushing the limits in other ways. So, like, occasionally in, you know, some of the classes at Berkeley, like, you know, a jazz class or something, what I was doing might be like really different from anything that they were teaching, but I think most people kind of enjoyed it. Actually, it's just like pretty unique and different.
I mean, the proof is in the pudding. If you can do it, then, you know, it is what it is. It's if it's compelling, it's compelling, you know,
right,
regardless of what it is.
So
you mentioned Victor Wooten as really being this wake-up call as far as the possibilities for solo bass. So what else do you attribute that to? I mean, why do you think that developing a technique and pushing in that direction was so appealing to you? What can you point to in your life that you think that's the kind of the path you went down?
I think part of it is the fact that I started out on piano.
Mm.
So I had a lot of experience playing solo and accompanying myself already. I think another part of it was that I find that I often work best alone. I find that I often work best when I'm creating stuff by myself. I have done a lot of collaboration and I love doing it, but I like the main part of what I do to be kind of me expressing myself exactly the way I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I've played in bands and stuff, and I've always just found that I really like having the freedom of playing solo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, logistically, it's so nice too, to be able to, you know, back when I was playing more live shows, just be able to go out on a tour literally whenever I want. It's just me driving around playing shows. Like, I don't need to check with other band members or anything like that.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, reduces a lot of stress not having to deal with with all that, or share a room even.
It's just nice to be able to like tour when I feel like touring. It's like, okay, I've been sitting at home for a while, let's just go out and tour, and then I can just do it.
So that, you know, that kind of leads me to so, you know, when you left Berkeley, you graduated, you did all 4 years there, right? And you got your degree there. Where did you see yourself going at that moment? What was your ambition? Did you, so I know you still live in Boston. What were your thoughts at that moment as far as, okay, now I'm done with my training, at least the formal training.
Yeah.
I want to make a career out of this. Like, what were your thoughts in that moment? I'm curious.
Well, at that point, I was doing a little bit of online stuff, but I don't think, I hadn't quite realized the potential of online, you know, uploading content at that point. So I was definitely way more focused on playing live shows. Like, I just wanted to build up a fan base who would come out and see me play, you know, starting off in my local area and then hopefully, like, you know, developing a fan base around the country. And I tried that out for a while and found that it wasn't really gaining much traction. I was playing just all kinds of shows, like whatever I could. Like, I was just trying to play as much as I could. Like, I didn't really know any other way of developing a fan base beyond just playing a load of shows.
I mean, that's kind of the way to do it. I think you were right.
Right.
You know, at least as far as performance is concerned. Yeah. Wait, how did you know to even do that? How did you know how to book and promote and make a tour happen? I mean, is that just consulting with your friends and peers, or did you just do a bunch of research, or how'd that all come together for you?
A little bit, yeah. It was I played in a, you know, one of the bands that I played with, he showed me how he booked all of his shows. It was on this website, Indie on the Move. I don't know if you know it.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's this database where you've just got like all these venues, and it's got like the
who to call.
Exactly. So back when I was really playing a lot of shows, I would just like kind of go on Indie on the Move, whatever region I was trying to tour in, I would just like email every single venue, just be like, hey, you know, I like crafted a booking email and everything. I was like, I've done this, I've got this many followers or whatever, like, you know, can I play at your place, basically?
Yeah.
And like, that's how I booked most of my shows initially. Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the kind of the downside potentially of doing everything on your own is you're doing everything on your
own,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
You don't get to delegate to somebody. It's all, it's all falls on you. Yeah. So you said you had a, you know, you were developing an online, you know, profile. Where did that start? Was that on YouTube or on Instagram, or how did that all begin for you?
Yeah, I had my YouTube channel. I was, you know, I was getting my videos done by my friend Grant Stinnett. He had his own following. It was pretty decent at that point. And he was helping me out filming, kind of giving me some tips with YouTube. But I was mainly just kind of doing my original stuff, just like 2 to 3 minute videos, just playing through, like not really much talking or anything like that. So it wasn't getting too much traction. I was only maybe uploading like once a month or something. So, and they were getting, you know, a few thousand views each. So there wasn't that much of a follow.
It didn't really break through.
Yeah.
Now, were you playing that same bass at that time? Have you played that bass all through?
Yeah.
You want to grab it? Let's just, you might as well check it out.
Yeah.
I think people want to look at it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've been playing this for...
So you had that at Berkeley?
I did.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, not in my very first year, but I got it in my second year or something like that. Yeah.
Is that your only axe, really, or are you playing other things?
I'm playing other stuff. Like, I've got, you know, I've got like a 5-string and a 6-string.
Oh, cool.
The 6-string is really nice for tapping, actually. Really nice, like, you know, more complex chords and stuff like that.
Yeah, so like I said at the beginning, I think one of the most interesting things about your path through music thus far has been you've taken what I think is like a very contemporary approach, which is instead of maybe the old approach, which is wait for the phone to ring and wait for that tour to come along or that big record to come along. You kind of, I think, you know, the opportunity for people to become content creators has and circumvent all the old middlemen, you know, whether it's record labels or publicists or all that stuff. That's kind of what is the good side of kind of the internet of today. And I think you've really done an amazing job with that. So what can you point to where your channel really started to take off? Like, what did you change about the way you were developing content or the way you're thinking about content?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting actually, because right before it took off, I had kind of actually taken a bit of a break from YouTube. I wasn't getting much traction on there, and I was started focusing more on just playing live shows, like even more than before. But what happened was that's when I did some collaborations with that guy, Davey504. He's like another YouTuber with a massive following. And he does these crazy challenges where he like hires bassists to play the best bass solo ever or something like that, or like the hardest bass solo ever. And I was working on Fiverr at that point, you know. I was doing session based.
So describe Fiverr. Fiverr is like a website that you can hire people to work on your projects.
Yeah, it's like a website for freelancers.
Right.
Like you can just, it's got all kinds of different things like photography and graphic design, whatever. Like you hire freelancers to work on your projects, and session musicians is just one of the categories. And so I was working on there, and he always goes on Fiverr to hire people for his crazy challenges.
Right.
And like one day I just got an order from him, and he just said like, "Hi, can you create the best bass solo ever?" And I was like, "I'll try." And like his
No other guidance, just the best bass solo ever.
Yeah, okay. That was it.
All right.
And
no pressure.
Yeah, exactly. And like his username on Fiverr was something like not Davey504 or something like that. It was like just not Davey 5. I was like, okay, so this is Davey. Like, and I put loads of effort into it. You know, I was like, this might get seen by like a million people.
Nice.
And then, you know, that video, I got in his video, I was one of the bass players, you know, playing the best bass solo ever. And he said some really nice things about me in the video. And then my friend Grant actually said to me, like, you really need to capitalize on this opportunity. Like, this, you're getting such amazing free publicity here, basically. And I was like, yeah, that's true. And I made a video where I played my best bass solo ever. I combined it with his, like, best bass solo ever. And I called it like the hardest bass solo ever. And like that video got like a million views. And I'd never had anything even close to that up until that point. And I just remember like looking at the analytics, and it was getting, there was one point where I was getting like 1,000 views a minute or something. Like I was looking at the real time analytics. And I was like,
that must have been crazy.
It was crazy. Yeah. And so that was definitely the turning point, and that's where I started getting way, you know, way more serious about YouTube content creation. Was like, okay, I have to take this opportunity. Like, I had all these like live shows lined up and everything, but I kind of saw this as like a once in a lifetime opportunity. Like, and I just started like working crazy, you know, working like crazy just to put out like 2 YouTube videos a week. Overnight, I just kind of became a YouTuber. Yeah.
Did you do a bunch of research? I mean, you know, everyone's trying to sort of game the system, and there's algorithms that kind of determine who sees what. I mean, did it go beyond just cranking content out and really trying to like decode and reverse engineer the YouTube system?
Yeah, definitely. I paid a lot of attention to what Davey was doing. He gave me some tips himself, actually. And I started realizing how many things I was doing wrong before.
What are a few things, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah. Like, well, definitely, you know, one of the biggest ones was I had no idea how important the thumbnail and the title of the video are. Like, I thought maybe they're fairly important, but like, it turns out that if people aren't clicking on your video enough, then the YouTube algorithm just stops showing it. It just like, and I didn't realize that. I just thought it's going to show it to all your subscribers and that's it. But it doesn't even show it to all your subscribers if enough, you know, not enough people are clicking on it.
Right.
So that was huge. That's when I started putting a lot of effort into the title.
And so the title, I mean, we're talking really, not to be pejorative, but we're talking about clickbait in the sense that baiting someone to click on your thumbnail. So what specifically did you find worked versus what wasn't working?
I found that, you know, often there has to be kind of like some sort of theme or concept to the video beyond it just being like another original solo bass piece. Like, you know, if there can be some kind of original concept, like I had one video that was when you hit a wrong note in classical versus jazz. And that just sounds like something funny, you know, it just sounds like I want to see what happens.
People want to know, yeah.
Exactly. Right. Whereas like if I uploaded a video that was just called, you know, say like Enchanted Night, like that's one of the names of one of my pieces. It doesn't make people click on it.
Like why would they care? Like,
yeah, it's just like, maybe it's good. I have no idea. Yeah. And you know, that can be tough to come up with something that's going to get people to click on it every single time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I started trying to figure out how to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm curious if, what is your response to, I mean, there's definitely, and no matter what in life, there's going to be some traditionalists, there's going to be haters, there's going to be people that it's not the way things used to be, you know? So, what is your response to people who, for example, might say that in service of getting clicks and views, people are highlighting the more sensational and exciting parts of music, and that might work for them, but then there might be people watching who think that that's what music is all about. Like, how do you navigate all of that? Because you're obviously, I mean, from the last few days, you're super musical, and your content is very, very strongly musical. It's not all just flash and excitement, you know, it's real music, but you must hear feedback like that. I would guess, because knowing just how weirdly conservative some musicians can be.
Yeah. I would say it's definitely kind of a balancing act. Like I can definitely understand when someone gets put off when someone's just trying to play as fast as they can. Like I think a lot of it just comes down to what the intention behind the music is. Like, if the person playing is literally just trying to show off, like literally just trying to like prove how fast they can play, then it doesn't usually do that much beyond just kind of be impressive, you know? And like, impressive is fine, but obviously there's a lot more to music than just being impressive. So I do think that sometimes people have a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to something like tapping, because I think they've seen so much, you know, of people showing off and just trying to play as fast as they can, that now whenever they see tapping, without even really actually, you know, taking it in, they just immediately think, oh, you know, more tapping. Yeah, like, this guy's... Yeah, exactly. And, like, I'm not saying, like, no one has any right to criticize my music or anything like that, obviously, but I do think there is a good amount of that happening where people have kind of just... they've got so used to thinking of tapping as just, and even just flashy bass playing in general, like virtuosic bass playing, like they've got so used to that being just a tool that people use to show off, that they don't give any virtuosic bass playing a chance. And, you know, I think that's a little bit sad, because I don't think bass should just be kept in this box of like, you can only play bass lines on bass, because if you listen to any Victor Wooten solo bass, you know, you realize that it can be so beautiful beyond just playing bass lines.
Yeah, it's interesting. There, I was talking to a friend and we were saying how he's a piano player, and he was saying it's almost unfair that there's something about the timbre of the bass and what happens when the bass steps out melodically or for a solo, that even really simple things that would sound kind of dull on another instrument sound really cool because of bass. There's just something like instantly cool about about bass. I know what you mean. I mean, yeah, I used to play, might have had that attitude about tapping as well to some degree, like it's kind of like frivolous.
Yeah.
And then I did a tour with Stanley Jordan, the guitar player, who was playing extremely legit bebop and a million other amazing things, and that definitely turned me around. And I think you know, maybe speak to the way that tapping, because that's really where our focus has been for these courses, it really unlocks a whole new side of the instrument, because now it's really the only technique where you can play two simultaneous voices that's sort of in counterpoint with each other.
Definitely. Yeah, it really allows you to play stuff that is just, you know, there isn't really another technique that lets you kind of be playing the root notes in one hand and then the melody in the other hand. And that really frees you up so much when it comes to playing solo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that's immediately notable, I think, when people watch your content is it looks like the result of a ton of work and practice. Mm. So I'm guessing you're a pretty hardcore practicer. And,
yeah.
And if so, and what is it that you practice? And are you really organized about that and disciplined? Or what is your practice routine like?
It's definitely changed a lot. Mm-hmm. When I was at Berkeley, I was in full practice mode. That's when I was practicing, you know, maybe they're probably at the peak of it. I was practicing like 6 hours a day when I could. And it was, you know, it began with mainly exercises, especially on the tapping side of things, like, you know, a lot of the exercises that I did in these courses. And then my teacher had this book called 12 Keys to Success, and it was it was all these etudes,
yeah. Uh-huh.
In all 12 keys.
That's what I'm missing.
Yeah. And I learned a lot of those. They were actually written for fingerstyle, but he said just learn them taps.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So learn them tap, where you would take the voice and then harmonize it in some way, or
yeah,
unison, or just experiment with it.
Yeah, sometimes I would uh-huh, you know, play the root notes along with the fingerstyle stuff, or I would just play the fingerstyle stuff, but at like a really fast tempo and stuff like that.
Wow.
So I did a lot of that. But like right now, my practice routine definitely revolves a lot more around what my next video is going to be. Like I sometimes kind of make a video based around something I want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was one video, I was playing piano pieces on bass.
Ah.
And because, you know, tapping is kind of like playing piano.
Right.
And I just thought like, what if I just learned some like really famous piano pieces?
Wow.
On bass. And I made a video where I was just playing like extracts from famous piano pieces.
Interesting.
Like, I did like Fairlie's, you know, Beethoven. Yeah. And you know, I had to practice a ton for that.
And rearrange them, right?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Exactly. So like a lot of my practice, I feel like that's an efficient way of doing things right now, is to like make the next video be my practice. Mm. You know,
yeah, that leads me to sort of the importance of accountability and deadlines and sort of discipline, right? Mm. So it feels like what you're saying is you're sort of committed to this content creation path, and when the opportunity presented itself, you jumped at the opportunity.
Mm.
And part of what that meant for you is you're going to be making what, 2 videos a week or
yeah,
or, around and that. So in service of that goal, you have to suddenly get a lot of stuff together very quickly.
Yeah.
And you know, what would you say to musicians that, because you know, you hear a lot from musicians that they feel like they've plateaued or they feel a little understimulated.
Mm.
What role has kind of writing a check maybe that you couldn't quite cash at the moment, but you felt accountable to that,
mm,
been a part of your development?
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to, you know, feeling like you've plateaued or something like that, I find what happens is with more experience, you often feel like there are more limitations to what is possible, because you've tried out more things and maybe they didn't work out, mm-hmm, as quick as you wanted to. So I've kind of realized that almost anything is possible on bass and just in music in general. And sometimes I'll just set myself like a crazy goal, or like a crazy target for a video. Like, playing the piano pieces. Actually, no, the craziest one I did was playing really fast bluegrass banjo solos.
Oh, yeah.
On bass.
Wow. Yeah, totally.
And like, it's all possible. Like, you can do all of this stuff if you're willing to just like put in the amount of time. And like, I feel like that's a really good source of inspiration, is like, you know, when you feel like you've plateaued, I don't know, you've got to just kind of remind yourself that like, with enough practice,
mm-hmm,
you can just take yourself, you can really learn anything.
Right.
And that's just a really cool thing to think about and pretty inspiring.
Yeah. It requires a lot of faith in yourself.
Yeah.
Right? That,
yeah,
kind of trust the process, you know.
Exactly.
Even if you don't, the results aren't obvious,
yeah,
in the moment.
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself going with this? I mean, I know you're still very much engaged in content creation, and it's, you know, I would imagine, unlike many musicians, you know, who have been out of work essentially over the past, you know, year essentially because of COVID, you've probably been able to really thrive because everyone's home watching too much YouTube. If they're anything like me, they're spending way too much time on YouTube. but when the world starts to open back up, are you going to continue to just focus on content, or are you looking to get back into performing, or where do you see yourself, you know, in the short term?
Yeah. I think I'm going to keep my focus on YouTube. I might start doing some more live shows, but I feel that the YouTube, you know, the platform of YouTube is actually a really good way for me to present my music. Like, a lot of the shows that I did before all of this happened, like, I was having to play a lot of, like, bar gigs and stuff like that, and that's just not the environment that Solo Bass is meant for, you know?
Not yet. Maybe in, like, yeah, in Switzerland or something.
Maybe.
Yeah, something classy. Monaco.
Maybe.
It's huge in Monaco.
Yeah, maybe. But YouTube, you know, people are watching, and they might be watching just in their house with, like, no background noise or anything.
Right.
And they might be listening on, like, nice speakers and stuff like that. Like, it's actually a really good environment for what I'm doing, and, like, you know, I can get all the, like, the close-up angles and everything, and, like, that's a really nice thing for people to see, whereas just at a bar gig they might be, like, you know, 100 feet away, like, bad lighting, and
yeah,
they can't even really see what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So just from that point of view, I think that's a good reason to kind of stay more focused on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I think what's interesting, what I'm hearing that's interesting is the content creation isn't just for content's sake, you know, or just building a brand or something. It's about getting your music out there, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's just another means of getting people to listen to your art.
Yeah, and it definitely feels a lot more satisfying, you know, seeing people's responses on YouTube.
Right.
Like, you know, when, like, some of the bar gigs I'd play, like, I would play for 3 hours, and, like, you always know it's a bad gig when you finish a song and the, like, crowd volume just stays the exact same.
There.
There's, like, no applause. Like, it's like, I guess, like,
you just hear the football game on.
Yeah, exactly.
Been there.
And, like, whereas on YouTube, you know, you get, like, you know, all these comments of people, and it's like, okay, they clearly, like, got so much out of this.
And you're building a community, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Fans, and it's interactive in that way. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Charles. It was really interesting talking to you.
Appreciate it. Yeah, this was fun.
Right on.
Yeah.
Cool.